All right, so welcome. I don't know where everybody is, but thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming. It would have been quite lonely, especially on this cold night. So thank you for coming out. Been real tempting not to have. This is actually session 4 of Buddhism in a Nutshell, and my name is Karen Mastriani. So anybody here for the first time? Okay, good. Welcome. So we will do a little bit of a review from last week, and I did the chair that's facing out towards the aisle. I put the little welcome hand out there. So you're welcome to take that, and I'm happy to meet with anybody who's new after. And you can also download any of these discussions, any of these teachings. You just need to bring a flash stick and you can download them from the computer out there. And so Scott taught last week for any of you that were here last week, and I thank Scott very much. Everybody just kind of pitches in, helps each other out, and so it's wonderful because we're all volunteers. So we have a lot planned for this evening once again, and we'll see how much we get through. We're going to do a quick review from last week on karma and rebirth, and then we're going to start talking about the 10 non-virtues. We're going to talk about the principles of the path, precious human rebirth, and then the Lam Rim and the scopes of the Lam Rim. We'll introduce that again. Actually, the three principal aspects of the path are part of the Lam Rim as well. At any time, please don't hesitate to interrupt me. If it's confusing or you know I've said something incorrectly, I don't mind that being interrupted at all. I'd rather us all have the correct information and hear everything correctly. And just know that any errors are not the teachings of the Buddha. It's just probably my inability to communicate. So I will apologize for any errors right now, and I'll take the responsibility of that. The teachings are perfect in and of themselves. So let's start by doing a brief meditation. We'll do a little different one this evening for those of you who've been coming. It'll be different for you. And we'll set our intentions, which is a really important part of Buddhist teachings, is to set your intentions and then to dedicate any merit that you've gotten from those intentions. So many of you know the 7-point posture for meditating. So if you just want to sit in a comfortable position, feet firmly on the floor, if you're seated in a chair, if you're on the cushion, legs in a comfortable position, hands with arms relaxed, and hands with your right hand in the palm of your left. Chris just keeps falling down. What am I doing? Hang on, because I'm going to interrupt your meditations. But I can't figure out how to tighten it.
You can't.
No, I can't. So just be patient with it. Okay.
To get it off your ears, that should. Yeah, these could be really supposed to roll your ears.
So they should.
There you go.
Get it over my ear.
There you go.
Thank you, sir.
Can you bend away?
Ah, much better. Thank you. Ah, feels better. Can you still hear me? Good, I don't have to mess with it. Okay, resume the position. Hands comfortably just below the navel, right hand in the palm of your left. Arms, shoulders relaxed with your elbows slightly out from your body to allow air. You want your jaws relaxed, your lips slightly touching, with your tongue at the roof of your mouth, resting gently there. Head tilted downwards. Your eyes slightly opened or just kind of slightly closed, letting just enough light in. And the main thing is to have your back straight, like a stack of coins. And think of a string pulling at the crown of your head, just pulling upwards on that stack, so that your head is just slightly downwards. And just take a few deep breaths. and just become present to this space and think about your reasons for being here. And set your intentions to develop a more positive mind for your well-being and the well-being of all others that you come in contact with. And we know by our own mind state, we influence the minds of others. And then stretch to an altruistic intention of relieving the suffering of all other sentient beings and helping all others develop that peaceful, positive mind and state of happiness. And just remember that the purpose of meditation in our Tibetan Buddhist tradition means to become familiar. We're becoming familiar with our mind states, and how to develop virtuous, positive qualities of mind and eliminate non-virtuous states of mind. So meditation releases us from an uncontrolled, polluted mind. And we're going to focus our attention on our breath. And as you focus, I want you to try to notice the space between each breath or each thought that arises. So notice the space and try to rest there. And focus your attention either on the tip of your nose as air goes in and out your nose. Feel the sensation, the coolness, the warmth, the tickling, or the rise and fall of your abdomen. Whichever area you select, just focus your attention there. And just notice space, the spaciousness of the mind between the breaths. And rest in that space for as long as you can. In our ordinary perceptions, our thoughts and feelings seem to be all there is to our mind. One thought, feeling, image, or idea after another. All these mental contents seem to fill up our minds completely, as if our minds are small, finite containers. But this is an illusion, a misperception on our parts. Our minds are vast and infinite, clear and spacious. Our minds have no boundaries, no limits. When we experience the vast, clear spaciousness of our mind, the clarity of our awareness, we begin to see how our thoughts and feelings are like clouds in the sky, simply passing through this vast, spacious awareness. Not filling it up. Allow your mind to be attentive and observant of whatever comes to notice, regardless of what it is. Don't identify with the mental elements arising. Just simply observe them like a tourist. Allow the thoughts or feelings to arise as you observe them and pass away without getting involved. Just be aware. Just allow your mindful attention to expand, to encompass your entire sphere of experience of consciousness. Simply imagine your experience, your consciousness, as being just like the sky, completely clear, vast spaciousness without end. Concentrate on this experience. Identify with this experience. Clarity, spaciousness, awareness. Our minds are completely clear, just as the sky is completely clear. The light of the sun shines down on us through the clear sky. Our awareness and wisdom shines through the clarity of our minds. Sometimes clouds fill the sky and obscure the sunshine, but the sky doesn't get upset. The sky doesn't identify with the clouds. The sky doesn't judge. The clouds just pass through the spaciousness of the sky. They come and go. The clarity and spaciousness of the sky isn't compromised by the clouds. They just arise and pass. Our minds are clear and aware, spacious like the sky. When a thought or an emotion, an idea or an image or a sensation arises in your mind, just observe it. Let it arise and let it pass. Each thought, each mental event, just like a cloud. Concentrate on the experience of space. When we can simply observe these thoughts and feelings arising without getting involved, when we can identify with the sky instead of with the clouds, then we can reside in that spacious purity of our basic clarity of mind. Calm, clear, peaceful, open spaciousness, without agitation, without delusions, without anxiety and distress, without dissatisfaction and attachments and aversions. Dedicate all the positive energy you have created through the practice of mindful meditation to become a better and better person who is more at peace in life and who can bring more peace and well-being to others in every moment of every day. Yeah. Any questions or comments? A few folks snuck in here. That's good. So, last week, Scott covered very specific topics. He did a great review of the Four Noble Truths and suffering. So those who are here got that. And then talked about rebirth karma. And then we're going to continue that by just talking about karma and rebirth again, just a quick review, and then starting in on the 10 non-virtuous actions, which are really related to both karma and rebirth. So before I do the review, did you have any questions about what was discussed last week? For those who are here, karma. We'll talk about karma first. So karma specifically now. And thank you, Chris. If you don't mind using the mic, those who are new, otherwise it's a complete blank for anybody who's listening or when we're recording. Right back there. Thanks, Chris. And then whoever uses the mic, if you'll just hold on to it and pass it to the next person, that would be great.
So I have a question about karma. So everything that happens to you is a result of your karma, or are some things just serendipity?
In the Buddhist tradition, and what the Buddhist teaching is, everything that happens to us is due to the karma from our past actions, and not serendipitous or chance or luck or the cause of somebody else. It's truly our karma. We don't have the wisdom or the capacity to realize that, but when we are Buddhas, we will. You know, the Buddha realizes that and can see it. It's hard to get your arms around that. It doesn't seem like it. It seems like that car came out of nowhere and hit us.
I was surprised to hear last week that, you said what's happening now is a result of our previous actions, but it's not our actions in this life, but instead those in previous lives.
Correct.
I mean, because if I did something bad as a kid, it's not going to affect me now, but it's going to hit the body that I'm in later?
That's correct. So I know we all think about instant karma, and that's what we say. Their karma's going to get them. Or that, that's kind of a Western thought of karma. But in the, from the Buddhist teaching, in the Buddhist tradition, unless it's a really strong action, either of extreme generosity and positive nature or really non-virtuous, usually you do not experience the karma in this life. It might not even be your next life. It depends on the causes and conditions of when the karma ripens. And since we haven't developed that Buddhist, the Buddha mind, we don't know when it's going to ripen, next life or eons from now. But karma is definite, and it will ripen. We can do things to lessen it and purify, but it will ripen. Sometimes in this life, somebody does something terrible and something happens to them and we think, what goes around comes around. We have that saying, but it's probably not related to what they just did. Anything else? So as we review, other questions may come up. And if you just, you can just put that down so you don't have to worry with it. So if you remember, when Venerable Rubina was here, when she talked about karma, she defines it as intention. Like sometimes you'll hear the word karma is action, and it's an action of the mind. So it's the intention we have that moves us forward. So we have this intention, and then usually a behavior results. Either we spew something out of our mouth, or we have an action that results from that. And it's related to the law of cause and effect. And that is a law of nature. We know it in the physical realms. We've all learned it in school. It's a fact. And all And in the Buddhist tradition, they apply that law of cause and effect to the mind, which just makes perfect sense that it doesn't just apply on a physical realm, but also in that mental consciousness, in our mental stream. So think of it as a psychology. It's a psychology that leaves that imprint on your mind stream, and that's what karma does. There's no one watching. There's no one keeping score. So there's no, you know, there's no great scorekeeper in the sky. Venerable Tendrin, who was one of our nuns who was here for several years, we actually had the privilege, she lived with us for a little over a year, and she always said there's no cosmic scoreboard. It's just all on your own conscious stream that, you know, that we leave these imprints. Nobody's out there keeping track. But your actions do leave an imprint on your mind. You don't get away with it if nobody's looking or nobody sees it happen or if you don't believe in a god or a scorekeeper. It doesn't matter. You know, it will leave an imprint on your mind, both the positive and the negative. And so if you look at your life now, it gives you a pretty good idea of what you did in your past lives. And we're all probably pretty fortunate. We're here, we were born in a human body, which we'll talk about more tonight. We live in a country where we have religious freedom and we have food and shelter and clothing and, you know, the necessities of life. And we live here in Raleigh, North Carolina, and y'all found the center. So it's actually pretty amazing past life. So thank your caretaker in the past. And you can also predict your future mind stream because you're creating that now through our actions, our thoughts, you know, body, speech, and mind. We're creating our future selves as well now. So you'll have a pretty good idea. You know, we can't all predict karma. We don't know when the causes and conditions are going to ripen, but we know at some point they will, you know, what we're planting now will ripen in the future. So we create the conditions for our future realities, our future lives. And Scott talked about the four laws of karma. A couple of them I've already mentioned, but karma is definite. Every virtuous action can only produce happiness, and every non-virtuous action can only produce suffering. And it's the same on the physical realm. If you plant an apple seed, you're not going to get an orange tree. You're only going to get an apple seed. It's the same application. Karma expands over time. So a generous action can produce really great wealth, and a non-virtuous action can increase to huge suffering. And so that when we do something non-virtuous, even a small non-virtuous action, it's just real important to regret, try to purify, make the commitment not to, you know, do that non-virtuous action again, so that we can kind of lessen it growing in the future. When we're generous, you want to dedicate the merit so that you help to increase that generosity and growing. So, you know, you want to accentuate the positive and get rid of the negative junk that's floating around there. There is no result without a cause, which kind of gets to your question. You'll never experience a result that you have not created the cause for. And karma is not lost. every action will have a result. There's no expiration date. Doesn't run out. You can't hide. It will have a result. So it's almost just accepting the positive consequence, you know, the consequences of our actions. And, you know, they say that positive karma can be destroyed by one act of anger. So anger is really a powerful sword that we all just need to try to keep working on and try to eliminate anger from our mind streams whenever possible. And we are tried on a regular basis, so we have lots of opportunities to to practice. Any questions about that? Any of that I just reviewed? And karma expands over time. I struggle with that. but I will take it at face value, and I'll keep working it as my hypothesis. So if you struggle with any, and one, we're not trying to make anybody a Buddhist. So we're just teaching you information. So you just take it. What's helpful, use it. You know, what's not, let it go. If you decide this is your path, then keep working with it. Keep working with it. Take it as your hypothesis and then see how it works for you. And there is plenty that I have taken as my hypothesis. Some I wasn't even willing to do that. I was like, no. And then I would just gradually come back to it over time. And now, you know, I just don't, some things I just don't question anymore. But I don't want the negative karma to expand. I think that's why I struggle with it. Usually, anything we struggle with, it's because we don't like what's in our own mind stream. So, anything else? So he talked about the four aspects of karma: the ripening result, the possessed result, experiencing the result similar to the cause, and then creating the result similar to the cause. And the ripening result just means what type of rebirth we take, whether it be human or whatever. It's how the karma ripens in our next life. The possessed result is what type of environment we might be born into. Here in the U.S., or maybe in a war zone or somewhere where we don't have religious freedom to practice. Experiencing the results similar to the cause is that, you know, if you, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, but if you stole in this life or you killed somebody or you lied, then you're gonna get lied to because you lied, and you might get killed because you killed. So we kind of set up the experiences, experiencing results similar to the causes, and then creating the results similar to the cause. So our tendency or habits will repeat future actions. Venerable Rabina used a couple of different stories, but one was about a little boy who was like a magnet to fishing. He just had that karmic tendency to kill fish through fishing, and so we will create those tendencies in our future lives, whatever we have now, and we'll talk about that again tonight. So that's a quick review of karma, unless there's any other questions, and other questions may pop up, so feel free to ask them at any time. Bless you. So rebirth or continuity of mind. Any questions that came up for you on rebirth? That's usually a struggle, because in most Western traditions, we don't talk about rebirth or reincarnation as another word. You don't hear reincarnation, that term, used very often in Buddhism, because we're just talking about that subtle mind stream that goes on. And I just want to say that my son found this article and sent it to me, and I'm happy to send it to anybody who's interested, but it's a scientist who, in quantum physics, is looking at the continuity of the mind stream, and he has a pretty solid theory and hypothesis of why the mind had no beginning and will have no end. And this is in a Western science perspective. It is fascinating. And there was all, I just read the article, and there was also a video link to it, and I haven't looked at the little clip yet, but pretty cool stuff. And I do have my email up here, and so if you want to email me or leave me your email, I'm happy to forward that on.
My daughter really enjoyed the reincarnation talk.
Was she in here? And I forget, how old is she?
10.
She came to the first or second one that I did. Yeah. Wow. So here's the cool thing with kids and rebirth. Although 10's getting a little older, and I'm no expert in this, but they say that young children usually can remember a past life before, you know, that's kind of lost in their, you know, in their mental consciousness. And so there's a professor at the University of Virginia, Chris, is that correct? I think it's the University of Virginia, and he's even worked with the Dalai Lama on some things, but he was doing a study on rebirth in children and what they remember from past lives, and he's got some fascinating examples of young children describing vividly farms they lived on in their family, and they find these people, and the family says, yeah, you know, our son or our daughter died, you know, 5-10 years ago, and so it's pretty amazing what little kids can remember. And then there's adults that can actually, you know, keep going back and back and back in their mental mind stream and, you know, remember past lives. Most of us can't. But many can. So the thought is, you know, just like the law of cause and effect, I mean, you can't have a moment of mind without a previous moment of mind, and without another previous moment of mind, and another previous moment of mind. And, you know, they say that, like, within the snap of a finger, I've heard 64 moments of mind and 65. I don't know which is correct, but 64 or 65 moments of mind that we don't even realize that we have that many thoughts going through our mind, but we do. And each one is preceded by another and another. And you can go on back from until, you know, before conception in the womb. You can keep going back to other lives. And then you can actually go forward as well into what your future might be and your future lives might be. And so there's a quick meditation that we'll do just to think about that consciousness of mind, where one moment might lead to another moment, and how this all began. And I'm going to take, I pulled a few, some that are used in this class, but Kathleen McDonald, who was a Buddhist nun, and this is her How to Meditate. It's a practical guide, and this is the old one. This is the 1984 version, which kind of blew my mind when I looked at that today. We have the newer one in the bookstore, but the newer one was published in 1990, but it's a different color and the pages are different, so I won't even give you the page that I'm on for this. But this is a meditation on the continuity of mind. So if you'll get in a comfortable position, using the seven point meditation posture, and just take a couple of deep breaths. And just set the intention that you're willing to try this. You're willing to see where it goes and to listen. And just consider that it's one way of looking at the mind stream. Scott did a nice review of what the mind is last week. That clear awareness, consciousness that gets clouded with obscurations. And those obscurations are adventitious. They can be removed from our mind stream. They are not part of our minds. Think of it as a dirty rag. No matter how filthy it is, you can clean, you can wash it, you can soak it in bleach, you can get rid of those obscurations. Or a dirty mirror, we can scrub it. It may become cloudy and dirty again, but the essence of the mirror is still there. So take a look at your present state of mind, at the thoughts and sensations flashing by right now. Just observe them in a detached way without clinging or rejecting any of them. Now start to travel backwards through time. briefly skim over the conscious experiences you have had since waking up this morning. Your breakfast, getting off to work, cleaning the house. Thoughts at lunchtime, conversations you had, feelings, experiences. Are these part of the same stream of consciousness as your present experiences? Before waking up, you were probably dreaming. Try to recall last night's dreams. Do they also belong to this same mind stream? Continue to trace your mental experiences to yesterday, 2 days ago, last week. Last month. What were you doing in February? Recovering from the holidays? Last year, 2013. How about 2 years ago, 5, 10 years ago? Where were you working? What grade were you in school? What grade were your kids in school? Continue to check if these experiences are the same stream of consciousness. Avoid getting involved in any of your recollections. The purpose of the meditation is not to relive good times or sort out problems from the past, but just to get a feeling for the mind's continuity. If you find something in your memory that you would like to investigate further, put it aside until later. Go back in life as far as you can, bringing to mind experiences from your adolescence and childhood. People are sometimes able to remember their infancy or even the time of birth. Relax and open your mind to allow such memories to arise. You might even be able to recall something from another life. Having reached back into your memory as far as you can, now gently bring your awareness into the present. And again, observe the thoughts and feelings that arise. Simply experience your stream of consciousness as it continues to flow. Feel its momentum, one thought or feeling leading to the next, which leads to the next. Which leads to the next, on and on. Finally, try to get some idea of where it goes from here. Contemplate your mind stream flowing through the rest of the day and then tomorrow, the coming days, weeks, and years, up until death. What happens then? Consider the different possibilities. Does the stream of consciousness suddenly cease to exist? Does it transform into something else? Does it continue on, encountering new experiences? Consider these possibilities carefully, using the reasons given in other classes, that the mind is impermanent, it changes moment by moment, It's not the brain. It's not physical. It's compared to a vast ocean or sky. The mind ceaselessly flows. Although you may not come to any definite conclusion, the important thing is to look with a clear mind. And finally, dedicate any insight you have gained to your eventual understanding of your mind for the sake of all living beings. Could you remember things from childhood? My husband has vivid memories of childhood and being a baby. And we know that's part of this continuation of mind stream that we have. So, karma is the basis for Buddha's view of ethics. And part of that is, every action of body, speech, mind has a future consequence. And in our Buddhist tradition, we have what are called the 10 non-virtuous actions. And the idea is to start getting rid of all non-virtuous actions and really just, working on just positive virtuous actions of body, speech, and mind. So they talk about this body as being the caretaker of our mind stream. In my Discovering Buddhism class, which was a number of years ago, but I just remember this analogy and it worked for me. She said that just think about this body as a hotel room. We don't expect to stay in here forever. When you go to a hotel, you're just there and hopefully you have a really nice hotel room. And somebody took really good care of it. And it doesn't smell, and it doesn't have bed bugs, and it's comfy and cozy and nice hot water. And think about that's how you want to leave it, because you may want to come back and stay at that hotel room. So you don't want to trash up someplace that your mind stream's going to end up in the future. So be the caretaker of your hotel. Mm-hmm. Oh, good, you have the microphone.
I've often thought that I grew up in a United Methodist Church, and it seemed to me like it's a nice, comforting thought to think that, if you do good in this life, then there's a reward for you later in heaven. And a long time ago, people thought that the earth was the center of the universe, the sun rotated around you. I just want to throw it out there. I know we're thinking about the teachings presented here, but it seems possible to me that it's because it's a nice thought that your mind stream continues on and existed before you, that that's a comforting thought. And so I hear doubt arising in me that, well, is it just too scary for a bunch of people to believe that this is it? Nothing carries on.
There are people that think that.
Yeah.
That they think that this is it. That's not in this tradition, and it's not in Christian traditions either. That, they don't say the mind stream, but they would say the soul goes on. It's different than a mind stream going on, but it's comforting. Other people don't think it's comforting. They just think, I'm not going through this again. this is it. And we'll talk about that a little bit too, because that's what renunciation is that deep wish just to end the suffering. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But in many traditions, there's similar teachings and paths in all of this. I think that's a good point. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
You guys are getting the hang of this mic thing.
I had a question about rebirth. And I know we're going to talk a little bit more about rebirth, but from what you've just talked about, where does the theory of evolution fit in with Buddhism, like in terms of like the dinosaurs, were we all dinosaurs at one time?
Yes.
And then eventually became other beings and other types of species?
Yeah, yeah. So there's no contradiction with evolution, if that's my understanding, and the Buddhist teachings. And, you know, His Holiness, and I've heard him say this, that he has no problem with the Big Bang theory, that the Big Bang probably occurred, but it wasn't the first Big Bang or the only Big Bang. There were many others before that. And yes, we were all dinosaurs. We were all fleas. We were all cockroaches. We may still be cockroaches in the future. Yeah. 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 So I'm really, yeah, we gotta work on that one. Go ahead.
And I had another question. There was an interesting experience, and I'm not sure if this falls into Buddhism or if this is just something totally different. When my cousin passed away a few years ago, the three people that were closest to him and our family, really, whenever we would see birds fly, we would really think, like, of him almost immediately. And I wonder if there is anything that Buddhism speaks to that experience.
You know,
or if that's just me, it's just personal.
Yeah, who knows? It's probably just a personal thing. You know, but I've heard different things. Like, a lot of times I would have, like, my father passed away a couple of years ago, and I would have real strong feelings. And, you know, Geshe-la just said it's probably, you know, just a thought at that time. But who knows? Like, maybe there was something passing through or something happened in his life that, you know. But most of us don't have that realization. But it's not, whatever can remind us, you know, of a loved one, that it's nice. And who knows, in Buddhism, it could be that bird that flew by. And, you know, maybe we had some sense of a connection with that. Who knows?
Are there a lot of, or is this too personal of a question, are there a lot of members of the Kadampa Center that have reached enlightenment?
So, no, that's not a personal question. That's a good question. And I wouldn't know. And there's no way of knowing. If somebody tells you that they've reached enlightenment, they probably haven't. If you say no.
First time. Because even the Dalai Lama said that he's not enlightened.
Yeah.
So an enlightened being would probably never admit.
And they're not supposed to. And so it's up to us to think that everybody is the Buddha. And even somebody who, you know, I was in a situation several weeks ago where somebody was yelling at me pretty loudly and angrily. And, I mean, I just couldn't believe it. And I kept trying to calm down. I kept trying to think, okay, compassion for that kind of a mind. I don't ever want that mind, compassion, compassion. And then I'm sitting there and I kept thinking, okay, she's the Buddha and she's helping me practice patience and not anger. And that helped switch for me any negative feelings, because that's where my mind went, and that's where I was just about, you know, because, you know, we all want to say, how dare you? You know, how dare you treat anybody unkindly, let alone me, you know. So, yeah, just think of, you know, the Dalai Lama says, you know, the Chinese government is, you know, that's his practice. So use those situations as practice. And we don't know who's a Buddha or not. And who's achieved enlightenment or not. And here's the thing, you can't tell by looking at somebody. You know, just because somebody sits here and you think, oh man, you know, I'm worried about how I look and what I gotta go home and clean, and, you know, and they're sitting there all holy and they're gonna, you know, we don't know. Or somebody that's not paying attention, there's stories about monks sleeping and everybody making fun of them, and yet, I forget who the monk was. I don't remember if it was Milarepa, so I better not say, because I'm going to speak out of turn. But this monk ended up being this great teacher who had all this wisdom. And so you never know who's the one that's going to get there. But I just say, if any of you are enlightened, just, I want to hold your hand and just pull me through. That's the beauty of it. We want everybody to be enlightened. Please, I'm floundering. Please be enlightened before me, because then you'll make it your mission to help all of us get there. So that's a good thing. Answer your question a little. Okay. And when we think about karma, and the other thing is, you know, a lot of times we have this, and I think Scott's already talked about this, but we have this kind of victim mentality. We think, why did this happen to me? And that gets back to the question of, you know, especially when it seems like lots of bad things happen just to certain people, and you think, oh, geez, they're a good person. Why are these things happening to them? Venerable Rubina said something interesting. We never say that when positive things happen to us. We never say, oh, why did I win the lottery? I can't even do that. I'm serious. You know, why do I have such a nice house? Oh, geez, why? But we do that with the bad things. We take the good things, but not the bad. And you know, it's karma, and probably from practicing non-virtuous actions, and we can stop it. So there's no blame, there's no judgment. It just is. And one way to think of it when bad things happen to us is that we've burned off that negative karma. That's not an easy thing to do, but if you keep working with that in practice, I fell twice in the fall. I fell once and I broke my arm, my right arm, of course, and then, you know, that woe is me and I'm never going to be able to do anything. And then I start getting better and I fell again and I grabbed my arm to protect it and I pulled so tight I broke two ribs. And I was talking to Geshe Tsongpo and he said, oh, you know, I heard you broke more bones, and you know, and he said, I'm so happy for you. He said, you've burned off, and he was genuine. You burned off so much negative karma. I rejoice. This is wonderful. And I went, oh, yes, thank you. I have. Bring it on. And it's instantaneous, you know, for many people to think that way. And it really does help. And if it helps your mind to think of these things, that's all that matters. Whether you believe in it or not, it's all that matters. So, the 10 non-virtuous actions, and remember, body, speech, and mind. So the 10 non-virtuous actions are based on the actions of body, speech, and mind. And it's different than other religions. So other religions have the Ten Commandments. I know some of you are Catholic in here. Or they have the sins of this and tens of that, and they're all the same. So these 10 non-virtuous actions aren't that different in Buddhism. But it's not because a god says so or an authoritarian figure says so. It's just because they cause harm to us and to others. And nobody wants to be harmed. Nobody wants to suffer. You know, Venerable Rubina says, take a poll. Does anybody in here want to be hurt? Do you want to suffer? Do you want somebody to harm you, lose your house, whatever it might be? And none of us do. So no beings want to suffer. We all just want to be happy. And that's the basis for this. And it's not because you're going to get caught or somebody seeing you or it's because you're going against God's wishes. So you have three non-virtuous actions of body, and they are killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. So killing is taking the life of another, with a human life being a greater karmic hit than, say, an insect or an animal, but again, depends on your intentions and all the karma ripening. But usually killing a human is the worst thing, so we'll assume that nobody in here has killed anybody or intends to kill anybody. If you kill your parent, it's greater karmic hit. Or if you kill like a sangha, you know, a spiritual being, and since we don't know who is a spiritual being, it's a greater karmic hit, greater negative action. Stealing, from the Buddha's perspective, is taking something that is not given to you. So it's not just stealing from a department store or robbing somebody. It could be, you know, taking pens from your workplace or downloading music videos or, you know, making an extra copy, a personal copy at work when you know it's not allowed. That would be stealing. And then sexual misconduct is considered adultery or assault. So being with somebody else's partner when you know that they have a partner, forcing sex on somebody is considered sexual misconduct. So those are the three non-virtuous actions of body. So the four non-virtuous actions of speech are lying, speaking harshly, slander, and gossip. And so lying is outright lie, and would include exaggeration, which I am working on day and night because I exaggerate. You know, I'll say there's a million ants in here or, you know, whatever. It's always huge and I don't want that mind. And so I really have to work on trying not to exaggerate. You know, we think little white lies are okay. Are they? You know, my mom had some medical tests done today. She lives in Ohio. And I wanted to call her on my way here, but she would ask me where I was going, or was I in my car, was I home from work, and I would have had to have lied. And so I decided not to call her. I'll have to wait till, and that was only because I was going to talk about lying tonight, because I was already thinking, well, it's okay, I want to protect her mind, I don't want to upset her, so I'm not going to tell her I'm teaching Buddhism in a nutshell, so it's okay to lie. And then I thought, oh my gosh, no, it's not okay. I'll just have to wait till another time when I don't have to lie. So I'll call her tomorrow. Harsh speech, speaking angrily to another or trying to purposely harm another with our speech. You know, those knife-cutting words, that story sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never harm me. I don't even know who made up such a statement. I think some of the things we say harm more than a physical blow. Slander, in this definition, is divisive speech. So it's purposely trying to turn people against each other. And it's so easy to fall into that. You know, we hear somebody talking about somebody else and we're probably so relieved that it's not us that, you know, you kind of listen. And we shouldn't even listen to it. So it's trying to divide people. And then gossip is idle speech. Not really harmful, but not meaningful at all. And, you know, gossip, truly the basis is just wrong. Just wrong to do. But it's entertaining. It passes time. Most of our day is probably spent in idle, meaningless chatter. And then the three non-virtuous actions of mind are covetousness, ill will, and wrong views. And covetousness is jealousy, greed. You don't ever have enough. You're not content. You want what other people have. You're jealous of other successes instead of being delightful in what others achieve. Ill will is angry feelings towards others. You know, we talked before, a couple of weeks ago, about anger being like a poison. We drink it and hope the other person is actually harmed by that, but it harms us as much, if not probably more, than it harms them. So that ill will towards other. And then wrong view was actually talked about a little bit last week, in a little bit different context, but the meaning's the same. And it just means a complete wrong view, not of reality. So it's not in the wisdom sense, but it's just you have a total misconception of reality. you know, you lie about something and you firmly believe that it's the truth, either because you've convinced yourself or you're just really good at lying and believing that, or you harm another, you do something that you say is positive, but your intentions were really to harm somebody else, and you think, well, that's okay, because either they deserved it or my intentions were positive anyhow, or whatever wrong view that we come up with. So those are the 10 non-virtuous actions. Not so much any different than others, except the consequences are a little different. So it's not from this karmic view, it's not that, you know, we've sinned or that we went against, you know, another authority's will, but that we are creating the habits and we're creating our future selves when we commit these non-virtuous actions. So if we lie in the future, we're creating the possibility, one, that we'll continue to lie, but that, two, others will believe we're lying. So even when we're telling the truth in the future, in our future lives, people may not believe that we're telling the truth. If we kill, we're creating the possibility that we'll be killed. So if we really hate roaches in the house or ants or whatever it might be, and we kill them, and we kill them with anger and maliciousness, we are creating the karmic habit to kill and perhaps come back as a cockroach and be killed, or at least be killed in some way in our future life. I think that cockroaches, mice, ants, no Buddhist houses. And that's where they go. If we're greedy now, we could be creating the causes to be poor in our future lives. If we're generous now, we might be wealthy in our next life. Yes, Michelle.
So I have a question about killing. So I know a lot of Buddhists are vegetarian, but there are many who are not. And there are many monks who are not.
That's correct.
In fact. And then there are some who live by the philosophy, if you are given something by someone, you eat it regardless. So my question is, if you are a meat eater and you are buying your food from the store and someone is killing it for you, is that greater karmic non-virtue than you going and fishing and killing it yourself, or hunting and killing yourself? Because, I mean, I feel like I would rather take personal responsibility for it than have someone else in a slaughterhouse killing all these animals for me. That, to me, seems like it's worse because of the situation of the animals. And I know you can buy organic, but I can't afford it. But anyways, but I was thinking, okay, well, if I hunted, at least then I would be personally responsible, for these animals. And I know that that's a high burden to take, but yet I'm still kind of taking it anyways without any regard when I go to the grocery store and buy a package of chicken.
Right. So it's a good question, and it's a very complicated subject. And so I'll just tell you what I've heard, and at least that I believe I've heard. So being a Buddhist doesn't mean that you're a vegetarian. There's no stipulation to be a vegetarian. I am, but I've been one since college for just a lot of other reasons and not because of this. My husband eats meat, so we're a divided house. Matt does too. But, well, he goes through phases, so I think he's in his vegan phase. So if you hire somebody to kill, that is a karmic hit. But when you go to a grocery store, to a butcher that's killed the meat, you're technically not personally hiring them to kill. But so you want to think about these things. You eat meat because it's good for you and you like it, or for whatever reason, it's your protein source, and you eat it with respect. And you think about the animals that sacrifice their lives. We should do this with all the food we eat. But here's what I heard Rabina say. I don't remember her exact words, but it was something like, you think you're holier than that, than anybody, because you're a vegetarian. And she actually feels that in people who are vegetarians or who eat organic food, they're taking a stronger hit, because if it's not organic, pesticides are used to kill the insects that eat the vegetables. If it is organic, they've hired hitmen to kill. So instead of using pesticides and spraying it themselves, they hired out a bunch of beetles and other gnats that kill the bad bugs. We don't live in a perfect world. This is samsara. So we do the best we can, and we, with good intentions. It's hard. Like, some people won't eat meat, but they'll eat fish because they think it's a less karmic hit. I've heard Venerable Rubina say, there's a lot more shrimp on that plate than a steak or a chicken. So there's different ways to look at it, and that's kind of a quick and dirty glossing. But then there's lots of readings, and there's lots of ways that we can go deeper into that topic. None of it's satisfactory. You know, we had termites in our house. They watch your house crumble around you. That was a struggle. And we hire somebody to kill the termites. So I'm still saying Vajrasattva mantras to purify all those thousands of termites that are gone because of me. So we live in samsara. And there's consequences to that. You drive your car, you've killed hundreds of insects coming here to listen to a Buddhist teaching. So we have good intentions. We try our best. So just think about it for a little bit. Would you agree, Chris? Okay.
Something else that Venerable Rabina said, and said this a couple of times, is that cows live, or people have, through their own karma, created a world where we do eat animals. And it's the cow's karma to die to put a hamburger on our plate. You got to think about all those kind of things.
Because we have created the world we live in.
Right.
And we're born here to eat meat and kill insects and whatever other reasons. Thank you. Okay. So, those were the 10 non-virtuous actions. And then we have, you have the Lam Rim, which is the graduated path to enlightenment. And there's principal aspects of that path. But in this tradition, the Lam Rim text that we use in the Golug tradition is written by Lama Tsongkhapa, I think back in the 13th or 14th century. But he was a really high being, a high, realized yogi who wrote this beautiful three-volume text on the Buddhist teaching on the path that we can follow. And it's really meant to be a practical daily guide for how we should live our lives in order to eliminate the non-virtuous actions and only practice virtuous actions. I know we sell the three-volume set out there. You can also download it on your Kindle to carry it with you wherever you go. But it's a very complete meditation and that's how I like to read it. It's not like a text that you just read. It really is something that you contemplate as you go through it. I mentioned this before, and next week we'll probably talk about it in more detail, but it's the foundation of all good qualities, which is, I brought a copy somewhere, but it really is just a few-page guideline, or outline, I should say, on the Lamrim teachings. And we'll talk about that a little bit more next week. And I think it's posted online where you can download it. And if it's not, I'm happy to get a copy to who's ever interested, especially after you talk. And I keep saying next week. So let me say right now, before I forget, you know, because we had that snow day, next week should be our last session. We had to extend it a week, but there's already something scheduled here on Tuesday. It's another puja at 7 o'clock that couldn't be changed. And so our last class will actually be the following week, the 18th, so no class on the 11th. But if you want to come to see what a puja is like, you know, what is a puja? actually, there was one right before this. This is the second week in a row we had a puja before this class. So pujas are for different reasons. It's kind of a ritual in this tradition. So it's a ritual meditative prayer. And some of them are medicine for medicine Buddha. So, you know, it's to eliminate sickness and make medicines work. And somebody just had one for their grandfather who passed away. And so that's often common in this tradition. We had one for Geshe-la's father last week on the 49th day after death. And we'll talk a little bit more about the death and dying view next week. The one Tuesday is a Guru Puja. So it's a way to acknowledge the need for qualified teachers and the respect that goes with that. And it's quite lovely. Most of us don't have a clue what's being said, and sometimes they're in Tibetan, but it's lovely anyhow just to come and be part of, even if you don't understand it. You just get wonderful karmic seeds planted just by hearing it, whether you know what it means or not. So, the foundation of all good qualities is a good outline. The three principles of the path are actually related to the Four Noble Truths. You know, the Four Noble Truths was Buddha's first turning of the wheel, his first teaching. And these principal aspects of the path are part of the fourth noble truth. That, you know, the third one is that there is a cessation from suffering. And the fourth one is the path to the cessation of suffering. And so this is part of that path. And Scott introduced these last week, and he talked about renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. And he just kind of introduced them a little bit, but he really went into nice detail about it. And I'm not sure, many of you weren't here last week, so we'll still do a quick review anyhow, but when I think about renunciation, it's kind of what we've been talking about, even when we talked about vegetarianism versus eating animals and being born in this life. It is that wish from the depth of your heart, so strong that you live every day and night with the sole purpose of ending samsaric suffering, that you have just had enough and now you just want to live your life to end this cycle and to, you know, to let go of all the suffering, be free of all the suffering. The literal definition is the state of mind not having the slightest attraction to samsaric pleasures for even a second, and having the strong wish for liberation. So when things are going good, oftentimes we think, well, this isn't so bad. You know, this isn't suffering. And so it's that realization that no matter what, you know, there is this cycle of suffering, and even no matter how good things are, it will end. I mean, that's just that impermanence. It's just that fact of life. Yes.
Thank you. It's funny to me because when I think of Buddhism, I think of kind of the pursuit of happiness. But the fact that even in times of, you know, good, you're thinking to yourself, this is still suffering.
Oh, it's bad. I mean, flagellate.
Yeah, that's kind of an oxymoron. So it's an interesting perspective, but I guess if you're completely detached, neither way matters. But
you raise a couple of good points, very good points. So There is nothing wrong with pleasure and enjoyment. Absolutely nothing from a Buddhist perspective. And pleasure is good, and we should want pleasure, and we should enjoy it. The difference is, what do we do when it ends? It's that attachment to that pleasure, that attachment to something that we think is so permanent. And then when it's not there, we get upset. And so it's taking the good with the bad, enjoying that beautiful sunset or that piece of chocolate cake or your partner when they're there, but when they're not, not getting upset that it's gone or it's raining and you're on vacation or, you know, whatever other thing upsets you. It's just being able to keep that balance, that good with the bad. There can actually be more pleasure in Buddhism without that attachment, because there's no conditions then, there's no expectations. You know, I look at that face and he radiates no matter what. So it's just finding that bliss and pleasure and happiness in life that is, you know, based on the mental perspective of happiness and not external. So I guess that's the biggest difference. Most of us rely on external happiness. So when we have a good job, good house, good partners, good food, all is well. Things go wrong, and then, you know, we pile on more suffering on top of suffering instead of just saying, okay, this too will pass, and the good will come again. We don't often think that way. And then it's not detachment. So it's not like, I don't care about chocolate cake or pretty sunsets, or I don't need a new car. So it's not detachment. It's non-attachment. It's, you know, if I get a good new car, great. If there's chocolate cake on the menu, great. I'll enjoy it. If there's not, I'll take whatever there is. Yeah, we usually can't do that. So that's kind of the difference. So it's actually kind of an oxymoron to say this is suffering, but it's just saying that most of the pleasures we have are contaminated by our own minds and, you know, negative attachments that we have. And so it's letting go of that attachment that is renunciation, that attachment to samsaric pleasure, that attachment as if something's never going to end. We over-exaggerate the good and act like it's always going to stay good. And that's just not, you know, that's not really reality. That's not how things work. Even being born is suffering. The whole process of birth is suffering for the baby and the mother. From conception, you know, we know there's going to be death. We kind of ignore it in our culture, but we know it's coming eventually. And for some, maybe it'll be old age first, but it will come. Our bodies will change. They're fragile. You know, they can't hold up long. You know, they would get sick and old, and that's just a fact of our external life. So the more we can practice and work with our minds, the better that we can get out of this cycle of samsaric existence. It's like Groundhog Day. We'll do it over and over again until we can finally, you know, break through and get out of this. And that's what renunciation is. I don't want to suffer anymore. I don't want anybody else to suffer anymore. I realize no matter how good things are, it can be better. It can be better. I can have uncontaminated bliss. And that's what I want. That's what I want. And working towards that day and night. Some will give up worldly pleasures. Some will become monks and nuns, and that's wonderful for people who are ready to do that. That's one way. But doing that isn't the guarantee that you've let go of those attachments. So it's more of a mental process of letting go of the attachments, whether you become a monk or a nun or go live in a mountaintop somewhere with, you know, none of the worldly pleasures. What is happening in your mind? What are you working with your mind in terms of that attachment to those pleasures? So it doesn't mean non-enjoyment, if that makes sense. Enjoy all you want. Just don't be attached to that. So the other thing that's part of this is that realizing that the opportunity to practice and deciding to work with our mind is now, because we, without wasting a second, because we have this wonderful human rebirth. And while we have this mind where we can think through these things, we can observe our own minds. No other animals can do that. No other sentient beings can do that. We can observe. We can know what's happening in our minds. We have this awareness. We have the leisure of being born in this wonderful country, in this wonderful city and state that we're in now, that we can practice. And so not wasting a second. Because the idea in Buddhism is that this precious human rebirth is rare. Especially rare when you think of all the countries we could have been born in, we're born here. So we have the ability to practice. And one of the stories is said that to be born as a human is like a blind turtle that surfaces in an ocean, and it can surface anywhere in the oceans in the world. And when it surfaces, coming up, that if you threw a yoke, you know, an ox yoke, this was written back in Buddhist time, if you threw that round yoke into the ocean, that blind turtle would come up after 100 years of being submerged and be able to put his head through that yoke. That's how rare and precious being born a human is. And most of us dilly-dally. We think that we can practice tomorrow, or we think, you know, we're procrastinators. And, you know, the Buddhist teaching says, don't procrastinate. This will not last, and it may not come again for eons. So take advantage of the situation now and try to create the causes that we will come back a human again and have a good life where we can practice again. But there is no guarantee that that could happen. So really practicing that renunciation with that sense of urgency to make it work. Make sense? So I was going to do another meditation, but we may wait till next time and do that one. And then the second principle aspect of the path, that was renunciation, is bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is called the mind of awakening. And bodhicitta, which I've spelled up there, that'll be a good reason to sit closer to the front, is the profound wish to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. So it's that loving kindness. It is that is really the essence of bodhicitta. So it's the wish to transform yourself and your attachment in order to be of benefit to others, and kind of letting go of our own self-cherishing. So it's a different perspective than what the Western mind has, because it's me and I, and, you know, often there is this sense of self-cherishing. And in this, it's being able to let go of that and to realize that to be truly happy, to find true pleasure, and this is a scientific fact, can only be if you're helping others, and others have, you know, a sense of well-being and happiness. And we get, the more we can help others, the more we find pleasure. And that's the whole idea behind bodhicitta. And His Holiness has said that he considers bodhicitta selfishness on the grandest scale. He says, because we get the greatest pleasure. And he said, this is okay to be selfish on this grand scale with bodhicitta. So that's the one time you can be selfish. And you need to have this sense of bodhicitta and compassion and loving kindness for ourselves. Because if we don't experience compassion and loving kindness, it's hard to then be compassionate towards other in that true way where we don't expect anything in return. It's unconditional and uncontaminated. We just do it for the sake of having others be happy. And if you think about it like oxygen on the plane, you know, they tell you, you put your oxygen mask on first, and then you can help somebody else. Or if you're, you know, if a boat capsizes and everybody's in the water, you're not going to help anybody else from drowning until you get up out of the water into the lifeboat, and then you can pull others with you. You're not going to say, I made it, sorry. You know, it's pulling others up is what bodhicitta is. And so the Tibetan and Sanskrit definition of bodhicitta is a principle consciousness that combines the two factors of wishing to free all beings from suffering and of wishing to attain enlightenment because of that. Because that wish is so strong, you can't bear that other people suffer. And so you want to become enlightened so that you can help them not suffer. Questions, thoughts, comments? It's closely linked to compassion and loving kindness, where compassion is the wish that others be free from suffering and its causes, and that loving kindness, love and loving kindness is the wish for others to have happiness and its causes. And we say a beautiful prayer here that's, we say it every Sunday in most other teachings, and it's in our prayer book, but it's also in this book, so it's just easier to stick to one book. And it's the Four Immeasurables that just says, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that knows no suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment and anger that holds some close and others distant. And that really is the bodhicitta prayer. And when you think of this, when you think of equanimity, we'll do a meditation next time on equanimity that really looks at, doesn't mean that you just have compassion and bodhicitta for your family, your friends, and the people you like. But it's having bodhicitta for everybody, friends, enemies, family, strangers, equally compassionate for them. And so we'll do a meditation on that next week and talk about that a little bit more. And part of this, which I won't go into a lot of, but part of bodhicitta is it's empowered through the practice of the six perfections. And the six perfections are generosity, that we give time, materials, love, dharma, which teaching dharma is considered the highest act of generosity. Morality, which is ethical conduct, which we've talked about with the non-virtuous actions. Patience, which means more like tolerance. It's more not reacting in anger and cultivating the ability to endure hardship. So when the bad things happen, we're okay with that. And that takes some real cultivating, and that's part of patience. Joyous effort means that we're happy to do good things, that we don't begrudgingly do it, or that we don't get upset when we're not thanked. And think about that. I was on vacation. I hope nobody listens to this tape. It was a family reunion. It was lovely. And we decided that we would do the cooking and the cleaning and without any expectations, which was wonderful the first couple of days. And then it was, nobody's lifting a finger. They couldn't buy lunch today after we cooked all these. Your mind just automatically starts. So even when you think you're doing something with joyous effort, it just sneaks in on you. It was wonderful just to watch it come, and then try to work with that. Concentration, which is meditation and developing stabilization, calm abiding, which we're practicing meditation in here, and then wisdom, seeing the true nature of reality. And wisdom is actually the last principal aspect of the path, and it's that realizing the true nature of reality or emptiness, and we will talk more about emptiness next week. And so it is 8:30, actually 8:32. And so it's probably time to end, unless you have any questions. And I'm also will be here cleaning up, so I'm happy to answer questions then. Or email me. I do not mind being emailed. And I will share questions that are asked, because a lot of times if one person has a question, others may have it as well. But before we leave, just sit again in a meditative posture. Be comfortable. Close your eyes. And just take a few deep breaths. And think about what was discussed here. Take anything that's helpful, that helps you have a calm, peaceful mind. And if it doesn't do that right now, just sit on it. Let it go. Jot down questions or concerns. And just dedicate the virtue of making the effort to come here on a school night, a work night, crazy week and crazy weather, but you came, and rejoice in that, and dedicate any merit that was created to your enlightenment, peaceful, happy mind, so that you can benefit all sentient beings. Practice setting intentions and dedicating for these next 2 weeks, and just see how that works for you. Try practicing some meditations and see if that makes a difference in your day. Just 2 minutes a day of calming your mind, thinking about some of these topics, reflecting on them, sitting with them, reading about it. And then I'll look forward to talking with you in 2 weeks. There's no class next week. There's a Guru Puja at 7 o'clock next Tuesday. So there can't be a class. So the final class will be the 18th. I haven't heard. Have you? I'm sure it will, because we're starting it. I don't know. It won't be skipped, so the first session will be next Monday, and they'll go through information, and then whether they add on a week, I don't know. They might just try to, they might condense. Emptiness is a big one. So they probably will watch the website, and I'm sure they'll announce it next week, how they're going to handle that. Yeah, you can come in here and help me in 2 weeks, because you'll have two classes. Emptiness is actually quite fascinating, and on an intellectual level, you'll get it. On a practical level, we just don't live that way until we really experientially get it. I know. You get emptiness right away. It's interesting. And see, with me, I thought, oh, compassion. I'm a compassionate person. I got that instantly. And then it was like, for my enemies, for a cockroach, you know, then you realize, oh, my gosh, I don't get compassion at all. So you keep working with it. You keep working with it. Emptiness. And that's quite true. And yet when you think about it, and even not having a creator, that's not unique to Buddhism either. But it is a basic, the foundation of Buddhism is that. But wisdom, that emptiness, really differentiates from other thinking. But there are scientists now working with the Dalai Lama on the Mind Life Conference that are looking at these issues. And, when you hear about emptiness, you can't deny it's not It's fascinating. Can't deny it's not true. We might not get it, but it's fun. That's fun. Thank you. Be very careful going home. Stay warm.